In this video, I will summarize some of the most salient points of the Italian elite theorists Gaetano Mosca and Vilfredo Pareto, who wrote in the early 20th century. I think their ideas remain incredibly useful for understanding how power functions. Mosca's key work is The Ruling Class, first completed in 1896, but then revised and expanded in 1939, when Mosca was a much older man. Pareto's ideas can be found in an enormous book called The Mind and Society, published in four volumes in 1935. This was abridged into a much more manageable single volume called The Compendium of General Sociology in 1980. I found this much easier to consult. In his review of James Burnham's The Machiavellians, George Orwell provided a very handy list of the seven core ideas found in Mosca and Pareto. Number one, progress is largely an illusion. Democracy is impossible, though useful as a myth to deceive the masses. Two, society is inevitably ruled by oligarchs who hold their position by means of force and fraud, and whose sole objective is power, and still more power for themselves. No revolution means more than a change of rulers. Three, man as a political animal is moved solely by selfish motives, except so far as he is under the influence of myths. Number four, conscious, planned action for the good of the economy is impossible, since each group is simply trying to secure its own advantage. Number five, politics is and can be nothing except a struggle for power. Number six, human equality, human fraternity are empty phrases. Number seven, all moral codes are idealistic conceptions of politics. All visions of a better society in the future are simply lies, conscious or unconscious, covering the naked struggle for power. Orwell, who still retains some residual commitment to socialism, objects too much in these seven claims. For example, he complains that the conclusions are not true, that human equality is technically possible. Predictably, Orwell offers no evidence for his utopian claim, and even contradicts himself within the same passage. By equality, he seems to mean not equality of wealth, talents, looks, geographical location, height, and so on, but simply that every human being should enjoy a fairly high standard of living. This is not equality, but simply lifting people out of poverty. However, whatever Orwell's personal objections, let's go through the list. I'll say a bit more about each one. So number one again, progress is largely an illusion. Democracy is impossible, though useful as a myth to deceive the masses. The word progress here is a linguistic trick by Orwell. He means it in its social rather than technological sense, whereby anything that moves towards the utopian vision of social democracy is progress, and anything that resists it is regressive. Democracy is not necessarily a liberal aim, even if many notable liberals have supported it. It has, rather, been the obsession of the Rousseauians, radicals, and allegedly moderate advocates of social democracy. If politics is force by another name, and liberals stand against the use of force except as a mechanism for self-defense, then their chief political interest is not necessarily that the form of government should be participatory, but rather that it should be limited in scope. During the 20th century, probably the most excellent example of a state run according to liberal principles was Hong Kong, which has consistently ranked at the top of the Index for Economic Freedom. From 1961 to 1997, it experienced a 12,714% increase in GDP and a 6,128% increase in GDP per capita. The average citizen of Hong Kong was over 62 times better off in 1997 than they would have been in 1961. But Hong Kong did not operate under a democracy, and one strongly suspects that if it had done, then the state almost certainly would have grown, become more interventionist, and ultimately would have worked to hamper the operation of the free market. A similar case might be made for the country most frequently at number 2 in the Economic Freedom Index, Singapore. The usually left-leaning Huffington Post wondered in an article in 2017 how things seem to be going so well in Singapore when so many of the erroneous Rousseauian assumptions of freedom appear to be missing. The article compares negative and positive freedom, or to put it more precisely, liberty and entitlements. Singapore stands at the top of the international competition on freedoms from. It ranks first internationally in the World Bank's measures of regulatory quality, and second on the Heritage Foundation's scale of economic freedom, while the US comes in at 13th. Gallup's 2014 World Poll found that 8 in 10 Americans see widespread corruption in the US government, compared with 7 in the Philippines, 6 in Zimbabwe, and just 1 in Singapore. On the World Bank's Rule of Law Index, Singapore scores in the 95th percentile of nations, the US scores in the 91st, the Philippines in the 42nd, and Zimbabwe in the 2nd. With a population of almost 6 million, Singapore's incidents of robbery were only a seventh of Boston's, which has a population of only 650,000. When we turn to Freedom 2 metrics, however, one party Singapore scores well below the US on 3 of our core freedoms: freedom of expression and belief, associational and organizational rights, and political pluralism and participation. In its overall freedom score, the US earns Freedom House's highest ranking. Singapore stands in the middle of the contenders, and the Philippines about halfway between the two. The author notes with some surprise that despite this, Singaporeans are better off, better fed, better educated, healthier, happier, longer lived, and more satisfied by consumer services than their American counterparts. This is surely not at all surprising to principled classical liberals who have long seen that democracy can ultimately serve as a Trojan horse through which the state can grow. So that second point again. Society is inevitably ruled by oligarchs who hold their positions by means of force and fraud, and whose sole objective is power and still more power for themselves. No revolution means more than a change of rulers. In Pareto's famous phrase, history is a graveyard of aristocracies, which sees one set of elites replace another. Aristocracy here does not mean a set of hereditary nobles. It means whoever finds themselves at the top of society and at the levers of power. For Pareto and Mosca, the shape of society is virtually unchangeable, although the individuals composing it are never at rest, moving up and down, and depends on the distribution of physiological and psychological characteristics in the given population. Thus, it is a statistical concept, true to the principles of methodological individualism, and not an actual group that acts as a group as such. For Mosca, no matter the political system, there are certain enduring traits and qualities that those who rise in social status will possess: capacity for work, energy, will to rule, knowledge of men, and also a certain affective sensibility that is very helpful to rulers. In a passage that is reminiscent of Machiavelli's discussion of virtue and fortune, Mosca argues that those who inherit wealth and power are prone to lapse into idleness. Idleness generates softness and sensuality, simulates frivolousness of mind, and creates an aspiration to a life of pleasures unaccompanied by duties. A life of hedonism, free of personal responsibility, is likely to result in a fall in status, even for the individual born to every advantage. For to rise in the social scale, even in calm and normal times, the prime question, beyond any question, is the capacity for hard work. But the requisite, next in importance, is ambition, a firm resolve to get on in the world, to outstrip one's fellows. The game of seeking social status and therefore political influence is thus zero sum. One person's name is on the invitation list only at the expense of another's. In a critique that anticipates F.A. Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, Mosca analyzes the incentive structures of the public sector and warns that bureaucratic aristocracies tend to promote the worst sorts of people. Personal merit is one of the things that the passions and interests of men best manage to counterfeit. In autocratic systems, where success depends on the judgment of one person or of a few persons, intrigue may be enough to produce the counterfeit semblance of personal merit. In liberal systems, where the democratic tendency is also prevalent and the regard and active sympathy of many people are necessary, intrigue has to be coupled with a good dose of charlatanry. The public employee knows perfectly well that it will not help him to do any more or any better than others. He will therefore do the minimum that is indisputable if he is not to lose his position or his promotion. In such circumstances, the bureaucratic career tends to become the refuge of the talentless, or of people who absolutely need to have salaried positions in order to provide for their daily wants. If an intelligent man does happen to stray into the bureaucracy, he devotes only part of his activity and his talent to his office, and often it is not the best part. It seems that Mosca prefers systems that reward personal merit rather than its counterfeit, which is, I think, a wish that is liberal in spirit. Along similar lines, Pareto argues that the liberal society, i.e. one under a laissez-faire economic system, ensures maximum social mobility and the unhampered circulation of elites. All obstacles to this circulation represent so many limitations upon the creation of new cultural values, an upsetting of the delicate social equilibrium, and with it an increased danger of revolutions and social crisis. Both Pareto and Mosca, it seems to me, favour an aristocracy of the most productive. This is simply another way of saying that they are for free and open competition, which does not in any respect violate core classical liberal values. So the third point again. Man, as a political animal, is moved solely by selfish motives, except so far as he is under the influence of myths. Here, Orwell has somewhat undersold the sophistication of the analysis in Mosca and Pareto, because their emphasis is less on the brainwashed and easily swayed masses, and more on how the ruling class control the flow of information and perpetuate myths to set the parameters of political opinion. Orwell, as well as anyone, understood the relationship between language and power. Pareto distinguishes between a governing elite, comprising individuals who directly or indirectly play a considerable part in the government, and a non-governing elite, comprising the rest. The elite falls into two parts, he says, a minority ruling primarily by force, a majority neither able nor inclined to use force. As Burnham puts it, the ruling class consists of those who are in the highest and key positions of society, and a much larger group of secondary figures, a middle class, as it could properly be called, who, though not so prominent nor so much in the limelight, constitute the day-to-day active directors of community life. Ultimately, this secondary level of the ruling class is, in the long run at least, more decisive than the top. It is this secondary level, the non-governing elite, who attempt to police thought itself. We have seen, in very recent memory, how this non-governing elite react if popular votes throw up results that are not to their tastes. In 2016, the people of the United Kingdom voted for Brexit, the withdrawal from the European Union, and the people of the United States voted for Donald Trump to become president. At the time of writing, in 2019, it could not be clearer in either country that the establishment, that is, the non-governing elite, have sought at every turn to delegitimize or overturn these results. Why should career politicians Korea bureaucrats in the civil service, and Korea intellectuals who work as journalists and academics be so resolutely opposed to popular revolts that directly challenge their own influence and power. Again, it is not at all surprising to the principled classical liberal who considers human nature and incentive structures. In fact, it is entirely what Mosca and Pareto would predict. I should note again, for clarity, that the elite is never homogenous. There are always some dissident members of the non-governing elite, and even of the governing elite. For example, between 2016 and 2019, there were some elites, although they were overwhelmingly in the minority, who supported Brexit and or Donald Trump. The elite consists of various competing groups, one might say alternative governing elites in waiting, who stay ready to cycle in if the currently dominant groups lose advantage. Both sides, old elite and new elites, declare that they are not fighting or working for their own interests, but for the good of the many. Both sides are invariably lying. I would challenge those who dispute this to find me a budget proposal from any of the major parties since 1688 in either the UK or the USA, which does not offer a single subsidy, tax break, tariffs on specific goods, promises to help specific groups, or otherwise punish Group A to appease Group B. Even William Gladstone, about as principled a liberal as one can ever hope to find in high office, passed the Licensing Act 1872, dictating hours of operation to privately owned public houses, as well as regulating the content of beer. This act was passed almost entirely to appease elite liberal MPs who had a moral disdain for the working class and their drunkenness. In fact, this nakedly illiberal policy was a significant factor for Benjamin Disraeli's 1874 electoral victory, as he capitalized on popular resentment against the Licensing Act. So let's look at the next two now. Number four, conscious planned action for the good of the community is impossible, since each group is simply trying to secure its own advantage. And number five, politics is and can be nothing except a struggle for power. Politics is a zero-sum game, and the ruling class is always a coalition of minority groups promoting their own interests. Even in popular revolutions, the people end up being directed because collective decision-making is impossible. The members of the lower strata are captained by leaders from the higher strata. In an analysis that anticipates Mankar Olson's The Logic of Collective Action, Mosca argues that the power of any minority is irresistible as against each single individual in the majority who stands alone before the totality of the organized minority. Power, then, is always power organized. We are not far here from public choice theory of James M. Buchanan and Gordon H. Tullock, in which various special interest groups compete to feed at the trough of public resources. In fact, one can draw a straight line of influence from Mosca and Pareto to Buchanan and Tullock. Sidney Hook sums up Mosca's core assertion as follows: that irrespective of ideologies or leading personalities, all political rule is a process, now peaceful, now coercive, by which a minority gratifies its own interests in a situation where not all interests can receive equal consideration. In peaceful times, the means are public myths and secret frauds. In crisis, force. Whichever side wins, the masses who have fought, bled, and starved are made the goat. Their saviours become their rulers under the prestige of the new myths. The forms change, but the essential content remains. Hook obviously finds this distasteful, but can do little, if anything, to disprove Mosca. In the allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses, how can a mechanism which categorically moves resources from A to B work in the service of both A and B? B gains, A loses. Even in cases where B is ostensibly a service for A, let us say the military, which is there to protect its society from external threats, there is little to say that B will not transgress its remit. To deny this while looking back at the past 150 years of history is to deny history itself. Although minority sections of the ruling class will be organised, there can of course be rifts between various types of people in the non-governing elite. For example, Pareto distinguishes between two types of capitalists, which socialist writers typically conflate. He says, writers have confused and persist in confusing under the term capitalists, one, owners of savings and persons who live on interest from property, and two, promoters of enterprise, entrepreneurs. In reality, these two sorts of capitalists often have interests that are diametrically opposed and stand in even greater conflict than the interests of the classes known as capitalist and proletariat. From the economic standpoint, it is to the advantage of the man of enterprise, the entrepreneur, that the interest on savings and on other capital that he borrows should be the lowest possible. It is to the interest of the saver that it should be as high as possible. The promoter of enterprise profits when the goods he produces go up in price, while rises in the prices of commodities are of slight importance to him. He finds compensation in the profits netted by his own goods. But all such increases in price are to the loss of the mere saver. Tax imposts on the goods he produces do little harm to the entrepreneurs. In fact, they are sometimes an advantage in that they scare off competition. But they are always injurious to the consumer whose income derives from lending of savings at interest. In general, the owner of enterprise can always pass on to the consumer the increase in costs that results from heavy taxes. The mere saver almost never can. Pareto's careful consideration between the functions of the entrepreneur and the pure capitalist anticipates the Austrian school of economics in interesting ways. The model of artificially low interest rates, which promote cheap credit, high time preference, and immediate consumption, adopted by Western governments since the second half of the 20th century, has been to the advantage of promoters of enterprise and to the disadvantage of the owners of savings. One need only look at the political donations from Silicon Valley companies in the United States to the Democrat Party. Over 90% in the cases of Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, which has long advocated such an economic policy, to see the extent to which this is true. So the sixth point, human equality, human fraternity are empty phrases. Mosca asserts flatly that equality is contrary to the nature of things. But how might anyone realistically challenge this when looking at the facts of history? As Thomas Sowell put it recently, neither in nature nor among human beings are either equal or randomly distributed outcomes automatic. On the contrary, grossly unequal distribution of outcomes are common both in nature and among people. In circumstances where neither genes nor discrimination are involved, the idea that it would be a level playing field if it were not for either genes or discrimination is a preconception in defiance of both logic and facts. Equality is not and cannot be the goal of the principal defender of liberty, not only because egalitarianism in practice necessitates the virtual elimination of liberty, but also because equality is quite literally impossible. Height is a strong predictor of lifetime earning potential. What might a campaign of social justice for short people look like? As someone who stands at only 5 feet and 7.5 inches tall, it seems only fair that those who are over 6 feet tall should have a few inches of their shins surgically removed. Another study has found that people whose appearance is judged to be very unattractive enjoy a significant pay advantage over those who are unattractive, average, or very attractive. To adapt the title of L.P. Hartley's novel, there must be facial justice. We very attractive people will not stand for this. So the seventh point, all moral codes are idealistic conceptions of politics. All visions of a better society in the future are simply lies, conscious or unconscious, covering the naked struggle for power. Pareto and Mosca assert that politics is devoid of genuine morality. The classical liberal asserts only that the state should not be involved in administering morality, which is for each individual to decide for himself or herself. Speaking of which, as ever, dear viewer, I await your own assessments of the ideas of Mosca and Pareto in the comments. Do you agree? Do you disagree? And why? Now get out!
And a very special thanks to Stetson F. Lionel, The Ambivalent Onion, Christopher Scholholm, The Crimson Satyr, Chris, Kieran Haywood, Mr. A.M. Swainson, Radical Liberation, The Binary Surfer, Tragic Vision, Bailey and Aurora, Toyotomi Ami, Holy Spatula, Alexander, Froggy, Splice, Buck Hegit Society, Michael Meir, J. Greenriver, Michael Tynan, Heronius Napalm V, Vincenzo Rapio, and Edward Darrow.